Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Catherine Massey, a 72-year-old activist who loved her community, was one of 10 Black people shot and killed in Buffalo, New York on Saturday. Last May, after a local official lost a family member to gun violence, Kat Massey wrote a letter to the Buffalo News calling for gun control. For the past 8 years, 86-year-old Ruth Whitfield visited her husband in a Buffalo nursing home. After leaving his side on Saturday, she went to Tops, her neighborhood grocery store in East Buffalo. Ruth Whitfield was also shot and killed. At a press conference yesterday, her family said Garnell Whitfield does not know that Ruth, his beloved wife of 68 years, is now dead. Here is Raymond Whitfield, the youngest son of Ruth Whitfield.
I was brought into the world on Mother's Day. My mother shared with me over the years that I was the best gift ever, but I couldn't protect her on that day. I bear an extra burden because years later, okay, in my career, I took my parents with me to New York, where I worked, and we bought a house and we lived together in New York. Then we moved to California. And you know why we came back? Because she loved all of us, not just me, that much. She was happy there. Okay? And this was their home. This was Buffalo. She came back to Buffalo. And I just wanted to be known. And she taught us to be unapologetically, for those people who do not see us, how dare you not see us as American? We stand here on the blood, sweat, and tears of our ancestors. Right. And she taught us to be proud of that fact.
Amen.
Okay? Proud to be. She was unapologetically an African-American princess.
Absolutely.
Okay? And all else I can say is that many a times when we were together, she watched these channels, these news channels, religiously, all day, fretting for the world, okay? And many times I sat with her watching, and too many times we watched this man fight these same battles with other families, standing behind them, holding, trying to fight back tears and pain. And we sat there and sometimes we wept with them.
Yes, sir.
But you know what? After the cameras was over and we had to go on with our lives, we wiped away. We got to wipe away those tears and go on with our day to day. But this time, there's no wiping away these tears. There's no walking on with life. So I say to you, what are you willing to do so that the next time it's not you standing here before your broken-hearted family? What are you willing to do?
That was Raymond Whitfield, the youngest son of Ruth Whitfield, who was shot and killed in Buffalo, New York on Saturday. According to the Democrat and Chronicle, the family is considering a lawsuit against those who put a semi-automatic weapon and high-capacity magazines into the hands of the accused 18-year-old white shooter who killed 10 people and injured 3. We will discuss gun violence and why Republicans still refuse to vote for basic gun control on tomorrow's show. In a 180-page document, the 18-year-old shooter refers to himself as a white supremacist and an anti-Semite and details an in-depth plan to target a predominantly Black community. According to officials, he drove 3.5 hours to carry out the mass shooting. He was in the neighborhood on the day before the attack, doing what authorities describe as reconnaissance. We'll go into the document later in the show, but joining us now to discuss the community response is Liz Lewin, a journalist for WGRZ-TV in Buffalo, New York. Liz recently ran a TV report on mental health resources available in the East Buffalo community. Hi, Liz. Thank you so much for coming on, and our deep condolences for what you and your community are going through right now.
Thanks so much for having me. You know, this is, I was born and raised in Buffalo. My family is in Buffalo. I went to school in Buffalo. I to church in Buffalo and only moved away for school and came back to pursue, you know, my professional career. And this is a tough time. This is a tough time for our community. For those people who aren't aware, you know, Buffalo is known as the city of good neighbors. And we stand by that. You know, we help each other. We uplift each other. We hold each other. We take care of our own. And we take pride in doing that. And it was a beautiful day on Saturday. I know a lot of people think they know about the weather here, but it was an absolutely beautiful day and the sun was shining and kids were riding their bikes. And for a massacre like this to happen in our community, taking the lives of community leaders and grandparents and fathers and mothers and grandmas, pure hate, pure violence. I think right now we're processing. We are hurting, we're angry, but we're also trying to start to heal. And I think you heard that just before I started speaking as one of the family members. I mean, the grandmother of our former fire commissioner, of our former fire commissioner for the Buffalo Fire Department was slain. A man who has dedicated his life to our community lost a member of his own intimate community, his mother. And so I think a lot of us are just trying to wrap our heads around how do we move forward? You know, as a journalist, I cover these things all the time. Never in a million years did I think I would be watching my own city on national news talking about a problem that, in my opinion, has gone on far too long. Mm-hmm. So I think at this point, you know, what I have been trying to do, what I did yesterday, and I just mentioned I got home from work at 2 a.m. and is leave the station with not really a plan, but allow the community to help find what that plan is going to be for the day. What do people need? People need food. That grocery store is closed right now. People, we have our pantries overflowing. We've got our churches open, our community centers open. We are just trying to find ways to keep people in truth alive right now, because that Tops is in what we call a food desert in our community. I mean, there are not many grocery stores, bodegas, supermarkets in that area, like so many other things, primary care. And so we're just trying to find ways to keep people together and hopeful in darkness right now.
And like I said, you ran a report on mental health resources available in the East Buffalo community. I was just looking at your Twitter feed, tweeting about food pantries that are open, resources that are available. What are you hearing from community members right now? I mean, there are so many levels to this. The horrific, horrific document that the shooter left, which we'll talk about later in the show. And then, as you say, all of these incredible, incredible community members that he killed.
Yeah, you know, I spent my day. One thing that we have here in Buffalo is, you know, we have a tremendous outpouring of community leaders from the religious space all the way to, I mean, you name it, the YMCA. And a dear friend of mine, we have the Buffalo Peacemakers, and they, you know, are a big anti-violence group here. And what they really do is these are volunteers, men and women who go to schools and make sure the kids get out and get home safely. They stand on blocks at all hours of the night to make sure that our neighborhoods with our youth are safe. And the coordinator, Pastor James Giles, you know, I went to his office yesterday to talk about, you know, how are we making sure that we can streamline resources so that they get into the hands of these 10 families who lost their loved ones, 10 families who they're members of their family. We're just going to pick up some eggs, get a stick of butter, get a bottle of water. Things that we do and we don't think about not coming home. How can we make sure that they have the things that they need? So he's really working hard on that. And that report will come out tonight at 4 p.m. and also on WGRZ.com for those who would like to see it. But then I just really went to different parts of the community where we are holding food donations and food drives, where not only Feed More Western New York is collecting food for those who need it, but Top Supermarket, that very supermarket that was targeted, their truck is going to different parts of the community and stopping and putting together bags of groceries for people so that they can eat. because these people, their grocery store is now a murder scene. I mean, we can't really conceptualize that. So, you know, yesterday I just spent my day helping people carry their groceries to the car. You know, I ran into a gentleman who said, "I met you, Liz, as a baby. I used to work with your dad." And my tears just started flowing because in a moment of being a journalist and trying to be objective, I can't right now, to be honest. These are my people. You know, I am a Black woman who is a journalist. I feel this deeply. So I think right now what I'm trying to do and what I've shared with my news directors and my executive producers and my producers is the role that I really want to play is staying out there in the community. You know, it is so important that we talk about the nuts and bolts of this shooting. But I think it's also important that we understand how important healing is to move forward and how important meeting the needs and filling the voids of those people whose lives were tremendously and forever impacted, how we move forward together. I spoke to a woman outside that distribution site who looked at me and said, "Liz, I'm in pain and I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe. My 19-year-old daughter was on her way to that Tops and only stopped because she met her friend outside and never made it in. She doesn't want to go to work. She doesn't want to go to the drugstore. She doesn't want to go get her second COVID booster because she's too scared." My job is to figure out ways to help bring some sort of support, some solace, some comfort, some resources. I strongly believe in giving people the materials that they need to process and move forward. And I will use every network, every number, every name that I know to help facilitate doing that.
Liz, what can people outside of Buffalo do to support these families?
I think, first of all, you know, I want to speak on behalf of my station at WGRZ and also the entire city of Buffalo when I say thank you. We all feel so much love. We feel so much support. We feel unity. And I think we've seen this in the past 2 years, especially with COVID, but also with all the racial and social reckoning that this country has been going through, that is the only way we're going to combat this. Love is the only way to combat hate. And I think we need love on an international global level right now, not just on a national level and on a community level. That's the first thing. I think too, we have to really get real with our conversations about guns, violence, and how we're going to move forward. I think we need to pray, but we need to act. And I think that's really important. I implore people to have real conversations, to think about these conversations, not just when it impacts you and yours, but as you're watching this coverage and as you're listening to those whose lives have been shaken by what's going on here, let's not forget, on that same day or the day later, there were two other shootings in Orange County and in Texas. We're seeing a lot of copycat activity going on that has to stop. So if you know something, if you hear something, if somebody says something to you that sounds racist, that has an undertone of racism, that has an undertone of hate and discrimination, you can speak up. You can say something. That's how I think we can all work together to change this. So, you know, I want the world to know that Buffalo still and will always be the city of good neighbors. We will always put one foot in front of the other. We will lift each other up. You know, President Biden and Dr. Jill Biden were here this morning and spoke on those same sentiments. We've had our attorney general here. We've got our senators here. We've got our mayor. We have our county executive. We have our district attorney. We've got our governor here who is from Buffalo. We have so many people who are from this area, who flew here, got here, drove here, took a train to help lift us up. And we will see the light and we will continue to move forward. But again, I just want to say a heartfelt thank you. And, you know, it's going to be a long road ahead, but we'll make it. We'll get through it.
Liz Lewin is a journalist for WGRZ-TV in Buffalo, New York. She recently ran a report on mental health resources available in the East Buffalo community. Liz, huge thanks for coming on, and we will definitely follow you and your colleagues' work. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the conversations you all are having this afternoon.
Thank you. Well, in the last clip that we heard from Raymond Whitfield, the youngest son of Ruth Whitfield, What are you willing to do? What will it take to stop this? As we said earlier, according to officials, the 18-year-old white shooter drove 3.5 hours to carry out the mass shooting in a black community. The 10 people who were shot and killed were black. One of the three people who survived is black. In the 180-page document, he said he was radicalized online. According to an official who spoke with the AP, the shooter repeatedly visited sites espousing white supremacist ideologies and extensively researched the 2019 mosque shootings in Christchurch, New Zealand, and the man who killed dozens at a summer camp in Norway in 2011. He also repeatedly cites the racist Great Replacement conspiracy theory pushed by white supremacists and far-right media figures like Tucker Carlson and Republican politicians. White supremacy online has grown steadily over the past decade, fueling these kinds of incidents. 1 in 4 Black Americans have faced online harassment because of their race, according to the Pew Research Center. Joining us to discuss this are two guests. Dr. Adolphus Beck is professor of political science and African American studies at Winthrop University and co-editor of For the Culture, Hip Hop and the Fight for Social Justice. Hi, Professor Belk. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Will Carlos is a national correspondent for USA Today covering extremism and emerging issues nationwide. Hi, Will. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Professor Belk, I just want to start off with you. A couple days after all of this, we're reading so much about this 180-page document. More information is coming out. What's going through your mind right now? I mean, how are you processing all of this?
As a native New Yorker who went to undergraduate school in central New York and made friends with people from Buffalo who have connections on the east side of town, my heart goes out to the people who witnessed this awful tragedy, the people who were victimized, those who have survived and have to put back the pieces of their life. And that community institution, my heart goes out to them. And so the first reaction is always the human reaction. Empathy for the people who endured this tragedy and frustration or anger that it seems to happen over and over again across this country.
What about you, Will? You cover this on a regular basis. We've had you on many, many times. What was your reaction when you got news about this horrific shooting?
I have to be frank and say, you know, I was frankly waiting for the next one of these shootings to happen. You know, as someone who studies these online worlds and studies these groups, I knew it was only a matter of time. And, you know, was frankly surprised that we hadn't had another young white male or young male radicalized online go out and commit an act of atrocity like this for a little while. And sadly, I think that we're going to see more.
Yeah, we have these conversations over and over again. Professor Belk, to think that this was an 18-year-old who drove specifically to a black community. Where do you want this conversation to go? Because we always say, what can we do about this? What will it take to stop this? And I'm sorry that we have to meet like this. I'd love to have you on to talk about your book and other things that you're doing in your life. But the fact that he targeted a black community really needs to be emphasized here.
These are terrible, awful conversations to have. At the same time, there are many of us, by virtue of our work and expertise in the media and studying government and politics, society, who are in a position to have something important to say to push the conversation where it needs to go. In this instance, I think we have to let the main thing be the main thing. This was a young man who likely harbored anti-Black prejudice, who was then further pushed and radicalized in going online into spaces like 4chan, and began to more fully embrace white supremacy. I say likely initially held some anti-Black attitudes because, according to some research from folks at Stanford University and the Associated Press, a majority of Americans held anti-Black perspectives or viewpoints, believing that Black people are less intelligent, they're lazy, they don't work hard, they're less patriotic, so on and so forth. And when they studied deeper implicit biases, those numbers were worse. The numbers deepened during the Obama years. People were hopeful that Obama would help to usher in a post-racial era, and racial tensions were exacerbated during that period. So someone like that was ripe for the picking, who got bored during the pandemic, apparently, started going to some of these places on the dark web, and was therefore turned. But then we take the ideology in his drift as an individual and connect that to the widespread availability of weaponry, high capacity rounds, the ability to modify those weapons to make them automatic if they're semi-automatic, to put on high capacity ammunition in the ability that they shouldn't have been able to do that in the first place. He had motivation, he had equipment, he had the drive to stake out this community, find this target, and then ultimately go through with what it is he set out to do. All of those things are awful, and in letting the main thing be the main thing, some years ago in 2019, the FBI called white supremacy the greatest source of domestic terrorism in the United States. In March of 2021, they made a similar statement, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, in trying to get people to understand the nature of the threat presented by organized white supremacists and militias. And now here we are, after a series of events, if we start the clock in 2017 with Charlottesville up through Buffalo.
Will, to Professor Belk's comment about where people stand on these issues, the Washington Post reports that in December, the AP conducted a national poll evaluating the extent of the belief in the Great Replacement Theory, which you can tell us about later. In simple terms, it's a racist conspiracy theory that says white people are being replaced by people of color. Nearly half of Republicans said at least somewhat agreed this was happening. More than half said they thought immigrants came to the U.S. to some degree because they wanted to influence U.S. elections.
Well, I think it's very important we talk about terminology here and we get the definition correct here, because I think, you know, I've been writing about great replacement and replacement theory for years, and suddenly this is sort of the hot ticket that everybody's talking about. You know, I actually published a story all about this a week before this tragic event. But let's be very clear about what replacement theory is, because I think there's a lot of confusion about it. And I think and that speaks to these numbers as well. So there is a demographic change going on in this country, unquestionably. I mean, demographers agree on it. The census data shows it, that basically the white population, or the proportion of this country that identifies as white, is getting smaller. And the proportion of this country, you know, this country's voters that identify as non-white is getting larger. That's just a fact. That's a thing that is happening. That is not what replacement theory is, right? What replacement theory is the idea that there is a conspiracy going on, that this demographic change is being specifically orchestrated and specifically designed by sort of a shadowy cabal of elites, and particularly by sort of Jewish people who are running the show, who are doing this. That is what replacement theory is. And so I think when people are asked, when you ask sort of, you know, Joe on the street or Jane on the street, you know, do you believe that white voters are being replaced? A lot of them might say, well, there are fewer white voters going forward, so therefore that must be happening. But that's not what the great replacement is. That's not what replacement theory is. What replacement theory is that this is being done on purpose. It's being done specifically. And that's what people like this shooter in Buffalo believe. That's what white supremacists in this country and across the world believe, is not only that this demographic change is happening, but that it is being planned and orchestrated on purpose. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to sort of cast any aspersions on that data, but I do think it's important to recognize that what people think the Great Replacement is often sort of depends who you ask. And we have to be clear about, you know, the people who really believe these crazy conspiracy theories, who are going to use that as kind of fuel to go out and commit these hateful atrocities, and large numbers of our electorate who look at the fact that the electorate is changing and sort of see that there's a demographic change going on in this country and recognize that that is a fact. Does that make sense?
Yes, and we can elaborate on that after a break. That is Will Carlos, national correspondent for USA Today, covering extremism. And Dr. Adolphus Belk is professor of political science and African-American studies at Winthrop University and co-editor of For the Culture, Hip Hop and the Fight for Social Justice. If you'd like to join us, what can we do about this? What can we do to stop these horrific shootings? There are so many layers to all of this. Racism, online hate, what we're hearing on Fox, what we're now hearing from Republican politicians. How should society respond to this? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we'll continue this discussion by talking about what to do about the proliferation of guns in this country. The 18-year-old Buffalo shooter legally bought a semi-automatic rifle in New York and illegally modified it with a high-capacity magazine, according to officials. There have been 201 shootings this year alone in which four or more people were injured or killed. Senator Dick Durbin says Democrats just don't have 60 votes for gun safety legislation, which is supported by the majority. So where does that leave us? Well, if you want to join today's conversation about where we are right now, what to do about people like this 18-year-old white shooter who drove 3.5 hours to a black community in East Buffalo to carry out this mass shooting. What does society do about this? What are your thoughts? What questions do you have? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Will Carlos is national correspondent for USA Today covering extremism. Dr. Adolphus Belk is professor of political science and African-American studies at Winthrop University and co-editor of For the Culture, Hip Hop and the Fight for Social Justice. Professor Belk, can you talk about the importance of history here? Because it's very interesting looking at the conversations people are having. A lot of people say we need to deal with the guns, and a lot of black people are saying, yes, we need to deal with the guns, but we need to deal with racism and the history of racism in this country. What are you thinking about those issues?
I mean, this is something that we've heard from residents of the east side of Buffalo themselves, that part of the way that a young man like this goes down this path is that he hasn't necessarily been taught the proper history of the United States. Prior to this, there was a big fight going from the spring into the summer months over how American history is taught. And some of it was rooted in the fight over the 1619 Project, but really it came out of a fellow at the Manhattan Institute who took critical race theory as an obscure legal framework taught in advanced graduate programs and law schools, and made it a catch-all term for anything that taught about race, racism, structural inequality, or the like. And at the precise moment that a full and complete education about this nation's history with race and racism is being sort of legislated out of schools, you have something like this, which demonstrates the sore need for Americans to teach and reckon with that history. We look at white supremacy as an ideology and political practice for many, many, many years, well into the 20th century. It was within the mainstream of American politics. It helped to fight for and protect the existence of enslavement for 240 years, for Jim Crow segregation for 100 years, for 50 years of racist housing policy. And the inability to engage with that does our nation a disservice when people are not able to understand the historical roots or the systemic nature of contemporary inequalities. The wealth gap that you see today, for instance, isn't a function of people's lack of hard work or stick-to-itiveness or their lack of character. There are deep structural issues that have created opportunities for some and prohibited opportunities for others. This young man adheres to this viewpoint when he believes that if these people of color and religious minorities are gaining in the American society, then they must be gaining at the expense of people like me. And I'm not going to stand for that. You know, the Charlottesville chant in 2017 was, "You will not replace us. Jew will not replace us," bringing back, you know, Nazi era type of attitudes and viewpoints. And this is what you see here. They look at the demographic reality, noting that whites will be a plurality of the society by 2050 at about 50% or 46%, but that's not a reality or a future that they want to believe in. If we had a proper education about American history and culture, maybe we could avert some of these difficulties.
Right. And so how do you think society should deal with the education issue at a time when ridiculous bills are actually passing? I don't remember the details exactly in Florida, so I don't want to, you know, say something that's not true, but people were talking about the potential to even ban math books in Florida. I mean, you can't keep up with this legislation.
The critical race theory ban in Florida was used to reject a couple of math textbooks, I guess, for the examples that they used in creating word problems to get students to think through certain sort of functions and issues. But in reality, it's about not teaching about race and racism in any way. So we can have elected officials who will tweet things out on Jackie Robinson Day, honoring him for being a trailblazer in American athletics and in society, but can't comment on what he was trailblazing and fighting against. And that's troublesome. And so what it really does is communicate to listeners the importance of paying attention not only to national elections and contests, but being involved at the local level. School boards and school districts make a decision about curriculum and instruction and what happens in their neighborhood or community schools or their district schools, right? So there's an opportunity for people to be involved in and pay attention to politics at the community level, the local level, as well as the state level.
So that's the education piece. And then there's the online piece, Will. White supremacists are using so many message boards like 8chan, 4chan, the Daily Stormer. For people who do not really know much about these spaces, have never gone to these spaces, can you just tell us what people are accessing so easily today?
Sure. If I could just make a quick note before I do that, I could not agree more with Dr. Adolphus's, you know, summary of the fact that that education is so important, because absent that education, absent that context, absent that, you know, the facts, essentially, these young men are essentially going on and they're learning really quite easily, easily disproven, but on the face of them, sort of very compelling and simple conspiracy theories that give them a very quick understanding of the world that sort of makes them the victims and other people the perpetrators of sort of injustices against them. So what these sites will tell people is anything from bogus sort of scientific studies trying to show that white people are superior intellectually to to people of color. That's a very common and popular theme, to a lot of talk about demographics, or basically conspiracy theories, anything from, you know, Jewish people are controlling the financial system to, you know, 9/11 was a hoax, the Holocaust was a hoax. All of those sorts of things are very freely shared on these sites. And then you have a kind of a darker subsection of these sites where you have these racist mass murderers really quite literally being worshipped and celebrated by people as heroes for sort of taking the fight out there. I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of days reading through this crime. This latest shooting is really extraordinary in the world of these events, because this young man appears to have left behind a very, very detailed account of what he was thinking and what he was doing and what he was learning in the days and weeks leading up to this tragedy. So he has essentially his diary, a Discord diary, where he's gone on and every day or several times a day he kind of writes about what he's thinking. And reading through that is really informative, because you can see almost in real time how somebody who's not completely stupid. You know, he's quite a, you know, quite an intelligent sort of seeking guy, but you watch him go down these rabbit holes where he's being sold these lies and these half-truths, and he's sort of eating it up with a spoon, and it sort of everything kind of makes sense to him as he's reading it, and it culminates in him apparently creating this, what he calls a manifesto, this I hate that word because it sort of imparts a sense of, I don't know, some sort of importance to a document that's, you know, an absolute pile of nonsense and garbage. But it, you see it sort of crystallize in this document where he puts together all of his thoughts about all of these different things. And it's all nonsense. It's all rubbish, but it's very compelling if you don't do the extra research to find out that it's not true. And I know we're going to talk about this, but I think one of the really important parts of this is that when you have mainstream political commentators getting up there in front of millions of people and really parroting and sort of giving heft and weight and sort of intellectual, you know, sort of intellectual capacity to these absolutely nonsense conspiracy theories, what that does is it tells this clear message to all the people who are entrapped and have gone down that rabbit hole that, you know, that there's something to it. Hey, it must be true because Tucker Carlson's talking about it on mainstream news. You know, it must be true because Laura Ingraham is telling millions of people about it. And so, you know, while I don't place the blame entirely at the feet of those people, I think when they repeat these conspiracy theories and give heft and weight to them, that's incredibly dangerous and an incredibly powerful sign to these people that you know, that they're onto something, that they figured something out, and it's very, very dangerous and destructive.
Yeah, and one more question about technology, because a lot of people are talking about what to do about these online platforms. And a tech expert was on MSNBC yesterday saying, even if you shut one of these platforms down, another one will pop up. There's just no way to shut this down. 100%. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, these people are always going to go somewhere. But I did a story at the tail end of last year that looked at some of the efforts that are being made to combat these narratives. The first thing I'll say is that, like, we know who these people are. Like, the people who study extremists and extremism, they know where these communities are. They know who these people are. They know that they're talking to each other. They know the messaging that's getting out there. So that's the first thing. This may come as a surprise to people, to most Americans, that, and I frankly, I don't think it should at this point, because there's been enough of these events, but it still comes as a surprise to millions of Americans that, you know, a young man of 18 years old is painting, you know, Odinist symbols on his guns and going out and shooting people and sort of putting together a manifesto. Look, I mean, hundreds of people who study this stuff could have told you, you know, a week ago that this was going to happen, that this was going to happen tomorrow. So that's the first thing. We know who these people are. We know where they're congregating. The problem is now, how do you redirect those people? How do you convince them that the ideas that they truly have are wrong? And I think, frankly, the number one way that we do that is that we clamp down on people in the mainstream who are reporting, who are repeating conspiracy theories. You know, until it is unacceptable in this country for a mainstream political pundit to go in front of millions of people and repeat a baseless racist conspiracy theory, people are going to believe that. You know, people are going to keep on believing that. So that's the first thing, is you know, I think there has to be some accountability for the people spreading those views. But there's also a lot of really interesting work being done to redirect people away from hateful views. So, for example, there's a company called Moonshot. And what they do is, when somebody searches for, say, the Great Replacement on Google, they buy up advertising that directs people away from that towards sort of videos and documents that completely disprove the Great Replacement. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff being done. I think we're at the kind of acknowledgement stage in this country where it's like, okay, this is really a problem and we got to fix it. And there are efforts out there, but they're still sort of pretty much in their infancy.
Professor Belk, what are your thoughts about how to address this? I mean, I don't want to read these quotes from Republicans. A lot of us have heard of these horrific statements, but they're coming from people who are in office now and then people who are even running to the right of Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, there was U.S. Representative Adam Kinzinger, Republican of Illinois, said, yeah, we do need a replacement. We need to replace people within our party who hold some of these wacky viewpoints that are in positions of power or in the Congress in the first place. And he was pointing that squarely at members of his own party, saying that there are some of you here who have been wildly irresponsible playing with fire, or even worse, you're true believers to some of these insane conspiracy theories, and you are not fit to serve. So some of those fully throated critiques are coming from within the mainstream of the Republican Party, though it's the responsibility of state and local parties to recruit and develop candidates for local, state, and even higher level offices. Part of the problem for the party comes in when those local or state organizations are captured by people who also adhere to these wild conspiracy theories. So that's on one end. So, you know, there's an education response, a socialization response, a community response. You can go back to the playbook that was put forth by Dr. King in working to build the beloved community that would be free of the triple evils of poverty, racism, and militarism domestically or internationally. But then for those who have committed criminal acts, there's going to be a criminal justice response. He committed a crime against the people in the state, and he needs to be held accountable for that, right? People of the east side of Buffalo want to see justice for someone who ripped away people who were important to their families and even to the community. So in the criminal justice response, you know, the model shifted after 9/11, 2001, in dealing with acts of terrorism committed by international agents. And you went from a responsive disposition to one that was preemptive. You want to prevent something like 9/11 from happening again. Well, in dealing with mass shootings, you would also like to see a preemptive approach that could disrupt these things before they occur. And that's where some in the Congress are pursuing something like the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act, which would give law enforcement authorities the ability to take some of those actions, right? And so you want to strike a fine line between emphasizing what might be a carceral response to a social ill, but at the same time, holding wrongdoers accountable for the things that they've done that have inflicted tremendous harm on people and communities.
We did a show about this years ago. What do you do when, for example, this 18-year-old shooter, according to the Buffalo News, in June 2021, he threatened violence in comments made to fellow students. Police were called by officials at his local high school. State police were sent to investigate him under a section of state mental health laws. He was referred for a mental health evaluation and counseling. What do you do at this point? If a kid threatens violence in high school, clearly needs help. How should the community respond? I mean, some parents might be involved. Some parents might not be involved. We had the case, was it last year, of a parent who went to a counseling session with their child, and they allowed the child to go back to school, and he took his gun out of his backpack.
I'll have a crack at that. So there are resources out there. So, for example, there's a group, an American university, that has developed a really great sort of syllabus, essentially, for parents, caregivers who are going through this, who have a child, a teenager, a young adult who is kind of going down a rabbit hole and appears to be going off in this direction. There are organizations like Life After Hate that are stocked with, you know, former extremists who are very available to talk to people and to, you know, to offer help and guidance. The problem is that these people, and even their families, sort of seldom seek help, right? So they have to be identified. And that's where you get into some very sticky stuff. I mean, the big catch 22 for federal law enforcement and for local law enforcement is, you know, is the fact that we have the First Amendment in this country and that people can go on and they can say whatever they want to on these online forums. And at least in theory, the government isn't supposed to watch them, track them, and look for signs that something's going to happen. But it's incredibly difficult. I mean, I my approach to this is, I think, as I said just now, I don't think you're ever going to create any sort of a system that identifies and gets in the way and stops these things from happening. I think, look, these mass shootings like this, they are to a large extent an American phenomenon, right? They happen in this country. These things don't happen in other countries. They don't happen in, you know, Brazil. They don't really happen in China. They don't happen in other places. And so what does that tell us? It tells us that something's gone very wrong in our society and that we have these problems are seeping down into, you know, and affecting these young men in this way and making them go out and do these terrible things. And so that's when I think a much more institutional approach needs to be taken. And I think, again, first on that list is we've got to tackle the fact that these very powerful people are repeating these conspiracy theories and giving them energy and giving them fuel, and that is directly influencing these people to go out and do these things.
Professor Belk, what would you add?
Well, in addition to having a First Amendment that guarantees us things like freedom of speech, freedom of association, and the right to assemble peaceably, we also have a Second Amendment, which grants people the right to bear arms, though the interpretation of the Second Amendment over time has become very different than its original intent. That said, states and the federal government have the ability to regulate weapons and ammunition. In response to the Sandy Hook shootings many years ago, the state of Connecticut did something. And there were other states that acted to do something. Some cities that are large enough that have home rule did things, but there was no new federal legislation. That effort produced a new organization, Moms Demand Action, which has sort of emerged as a countervailing weight to the power of the National Rifle Association. But there's a need for some federal action here if you're going to have something that's applicable in a uniform way across the states. When we look at gun violence in general in a lot of places, New York City or Chicago, the guns that come into those cities oftentimes come across state lines from jurisdictions that have laxer laws. So even though the localities have done things to try to deal with the problem, they're still subject to whatever happens in nearby jurisdictions. So there's a need for some uniformity that can come with federal regulation. And a lot of these things have happened with semi-automatic weapons since the assault weapons ban was allowed to lapse in 2004. Right. And in the decade that you had that assault weapons ban, mass shootings, if they occurred, the weapon of choice was handguns. Since the lapse of the assault weapons ban, the weapon of choice has been semi-automatic weapons. Mm. We can do something about that as a society because we did previously.
Well, to your point, Moms Demand Action just posted that in an average year, over 10,300 hate crimes in the U.S. involve a firearm. That is more than 28 every day. Easy access to guns gives a single hate-filled individual the means to shatter numerous lives and whole communities. And we're going to talk about guns on tomorrow's show. In our final minutes, what can people do about this? What action can individuals take? I mean, Senator Dick Durbin just said we don't have 60 votes on gun legislation. So what can people do?
If there's one silver lining to be taken from this horrendous tragedy, it's the fact that we are talking about replacement theory. It's the fact that we are acknowledging as a country that the biggest threat to lives across this country right now is from these young extremist men who've been radicalized online. You know, America is an incredible country. We have incredible resources. We have incredible amounts of money to throw at this problem. We're not going to start focusing on it until we acknowledge as a country just how big a problem it is. And I think that that's happened, or it's at least happening. So I think that, you know, what can people do on an individual level? Recognize that this is a huge problem, and, you know, recognize that it's something that we need to come together as a community, as a country, to stamp out and to cure, because I believe we can do it, but we ain't going to do it until we, you know, until we really give it the attention it really deserves.
Professor Belk, what would you add?
In letting the main thing be the main thing, the problem in this instance was white supremacy first and foremost before the availability of the weaponry to carry out this sort of sophisticated attack. This was a young man who subscribed fully to white supremacy and anti-Semitism. And if racism, anti-Semitism were something that Black people or brown people or Jewish folk could eliminate on their own, it would have been eradicated a very long time ago. But here we are. And we're here because we need more white folk to be involved in the struggle for freedom, justice, equality, and peace. Dr. King, in crafting Letter from Birmingham Jail, was not writing to the Ku Klux Klanner or the member of the White Citizens Council. He was writing to white clergy and moderates who said that they supported his cause but questioned his methods and believed that folks simply needed time to change. Meanwhile, people of bad faith were much more effective in utilizing time to preserve and calcify inequality. And so King urged those white folk who were lukewarm in their enthusiasm, who preserved peace above justice, to change themselves and get involved in fighting for what's right. And that's something that we still sorely need right now to deal with what was the main thing, white supremacy taking root in this young man's heart and head to get him to inflict harm on all these people.
Dr. Adolphus Belk is professor of political science and African American studies at Winthrop University and co-editor of the book For the Culture, Hip Hop and the Fight for Social Justice. Professor Belk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for focusing on an important conversation.
Will Carlos is national correspondent for USA Today covering extremism. Thank you so much again, Will.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.